And I was about to write down the invariant Lagrangian. So we had this story where we imagined we were kind of in secret thinking we was motivated by starting off with some vectors worth of fields, and then writing where we had the symmetry phi goes to g phi, where g is some n by n matrix. And we could choose the phi's to be real, so we could choose g's to be real. And then the invariance of the kinetic term would ask g to be orthogonal. So it's some orthogonal matrix would be the symmetries of the kinetic term. And then if we look at the potential might break that symmetry to some smaller group. So we're thinking that g is some subset of on rotations. And then the observation was that if we wrote phi as, you know, u of theta times chi, where in general g is some transformation. I guess that's going to a. And we divided the generators t into x's and little t's, where the t's e to the I, say omega I ti, was in some subgroup H, and the x's were all the rest. And we did that because we're imagining that say these t's all had the property that the t's, if the expectation value of phi, I call that v. And we imagine that the t's on v were 0, and that's what defined h, whereas the x's on v were not 0. So those are the broken generators, those are the unbroken generators. And we expected to get a Goldstone boson for every one of these guys. And so the idea here was we were writing u as e to the I, a field now instead of a parameter, times these x's. And we're taking some of the fields and we're going to think of them as being parameterized by these fields, and then the rest would be parameterized by chi. And so to make us not double count, we couldn't have had as many components to chi as we had for phi, and we wanted to remove as many as we had x's, and we did that by demanding that chi satisfy that a v transpose x alpha chi be equal to 0. And with these two definitions, we thought of this as being a change of variables from the original phi's into the Goldstone boson things and then the rest. And then with that change of variables, this group transformation law, the symmetry law of the action, could be rewritten, and it turned out to be this standard one. So acting on theta and chi, we have the transformation rule is, if we take u of theta, so theta alpha goes to, we're looking for a rule where theta goes to theta twiddle, and chi goes to chi twiddle under the symmetry. And the rule was, we take u of theta, we multiply it by g, we decompose it as being something involving the x's only, and that'll define for us theta twiddle, times something that lives inside H, which are called gamma. And that could depend also on the theta twiddles and on G and on theta. So U of theta twiddle is just like e to the I alpha. And gamma is e to the I some parameter, which we will try and figure out. So this is something that lives inside H. So the idea was that we're supposed to think of this as being, you do this multiplication, you factorize the result, And you choose, so in so doing, you read off this factor as defining what theta twiddle is, and then this is the rest, and that'll define what u is. And with that transformation rule, chi transformed to chi twiddle, which was gamma acting on chi. So that was a transformation rule which was motivated by this. And that was kind of as far as we got last time. And the goal now was to try and make invariants under this transformation rule. So the goal is to build actions invariant under these. We want to organize them in a derivative expansion. And we're expecting that the point of this change of variables was that theta will only appear with derivatives, because that's been designed so that if theta was a constant, then that redefinition took a form of the symmetry, and so then theta should not be appearing in the action if we did that change of variables for theta constant. So if we do that change of variables in the action, we're going to find that theta appears, but only differentiated, because the original symmetry was only a symmetry if g was a constant. We assume that we had a symmetry here where omega was a constant. So it was a global symmetry. And so we're looking for Lagrangian as a function of these u's and thetas, or these thetas and chi's, which is invariant under these transformation rules, coming to us in a derivative expansion, and we're expecting that the thetas won't appear at all undifferentiated because of the symmetry. All right. And along the way, I emphasized that these transformation rules had the property that they were inhomogeneous, so that theta twiddle minus theta wasn't zero. So theta twiddle was theta plus a constant, plus something involving linear things in linear theta, but there's also nonlinear terms in theta. And that's where the name nonlinear realizations is coming from. So for small theta, these conditions, I gave you what happens when you solve them. So delta theta alpha, by which I meant theta twiddle alpha minus theta alpha, turned out to be omega alpha minus C alpha beta gamma omega beta theta gamma. In fact, I should really make this general. This could have been a general transformation. I call that B. That's sort of theta squared. And this U that goes into here was equal to because this is the transformation rule, and the transformation rule for G doesn't have to live in G is an arbitrary element of the original group capital G. So the so if I choose a transformation in G which lives in the coset, so it's got an alpha index, then this would be non-zero. What I'm imagining is that omega, I can write omega A as being, you know, omega alpha for the things multiplying X alpha and omega I for the things inside H. And so this would be there only if I do a transformation that's in the broken group. But if I chose something in the unbroken group, then this would not be there. Whereas in here, this can be non-zero. This can be either in the broken or unbroken group, and this has to be a Greek index as does this. So this will be proportional to this particular commutator. So whether it's there or not will depend on what the commutation relations are between the t's and the x's.
Sorry, what does it mean, C alpha and omega b? Oh, that c. Those are subscripts.
Those are the c's. The c's are the ones that were defined by this condition that ta with tb is I times C, you know, D, A, B, D, D. C, yeah, and what we know is that if I take two of these guys to be in the unbroken group, then this guy is also in the unbroken group, because that says it's a subgroup. But then I could also choose a basis for compact groups where these were completely anisymmetric. So that says if I have if this is unbroken and this is broken, this will also have to be broken. Because if that was the, that was it, that was because I could choose a basis where C, A, B, C is completely anisymmetric under all these indices, not just the last two. And so with that choice, so if completely anisymmetric, and it's always possible to do this if it's a compact group, then with that choice, the statement that a commutator of a little t with a little t is a little t, that statement is a statement that C, if you like, alpha ij is equal to zero, because there's no x's here. But because they're completely anisymmetric, that also, that means that C I alpha j is equal to zero. So that says if I take the commutator of an x with a t, I get, whoops, I did it wrong. That's ij alpha. Yes, that's right. So if I take the commutator of a t with an x, I do not get another t because it's a zero. So it says that the commutator of t with x is an x. And that just says that these x's carry a representation of t. And so over here, that's what this term is saying. And not only that, it's not only a representation, it's the adjoint representation where the matrix that's representing the t's is the one that I build with the structure functions. And that's essentially what this says here. This says that I can think of this as being a matrix whose indices in the matrix are alpha and gamma acting on theta. And then which matrix I'm talking about is the one that B is labeling. So if I took this to be in the H direction, then this is just saying that the thetas are rotating by some matrix, which is what in that particular case, it turns out there's no nonlinear terms either. That's something I can show you separately. If I restrict myself to the transformations in H, then everything transforms linearly. It's only the broken generators will have these guys. I'll show that next. Maybe that these guys, these guys are all zero in the broken case. But let me first write down what these U's are. I was certain I wrote these U's down somewhere. These turn out to be minus CI alpha beta omega alpha. So now so the claim is now, in the special case where I take G to lie inside H, so I consider the case, let's call it H, just to emphasize it lives inside H. In that particular case, this transformation is easy to do because in that case, the rule is I take H times U of theta, and I call that U of theta twiddle times gamma, which lives in H. So the gamma I'm looking for in that case is just, or sorry, the solution for this where I take gamma to be equal to H. Yes. So that So that does not mean that H commutes with U. It means that I can find theta, the definition of theta twiddle will be, so U of theta twiddle will in that case be H U H inverse, if I just multiply on the right by H. And the thing is this, so the claim I'm making here when I say that this is true is that if I take H U H inverse, if I start with something that has only X's as generators, I get something which still only has X's as generators. And that's this statement here, that if the commutator of a T with an X is an X, that's saying that a small change of X's is giving me X's. And so if I exponentiate that process, this is what a big change would have been. And if I start with X's, I only end up with X's. So this statement here ensures that this is true here. So in this particular case, everything's linear. So this is saying that if I look infinitesimally, that says that delta theta is just that term that I wrote over there. It's minus C alpha I beta omega I theta beta. So there's no theta dot squareds. There's no theta squared terms. And then also it's true that in that case, UI is just equal to omega I. So why didn't I have that here? I probably should have written that. If I'm using the same consistent notation, I should have written that here. So if omega lies in H, then this is what I just wrote. And this is zero because if that's lying in H, that's an I, and I have I beta, and that's vanishing because it's a subgroup. And then the theta squared terms are zero, and that's what I've just shown you over there. If omega doesn't lie in H but lies in X, then this term doesn't appear because then these guys are zero. And then this is the guy that's the first term that appears because this commutator is now not zero. And then in general, there's all these other terms when omega is not lying in X. So the bottom line is that when restricted to the unbroken group, these transformation rules are linear and homogeneous the way they normally, that's the way we normally think of what we started with in our transformation rule in the original phi fields was linear and homogeneous. That's kind of what we normally think about as a symmetry, is it's some linear homogeneous thing. And that hasn't been ruined in this case if we take the, if we specialize this rule to the subgroup H. Our linear and homogeneous. But when we look at the broken ones, they both involve shifts of theta, which is a sign that you had to have a vacuum which is not invariant, because there's if I told you that there's a particular field which was the vacuum value for theta, then this says a symmetry just shifts it. So that means that there's no one field which is describing what the vacuum is for theta. So that means the vacuum must change under the action of the group. And the other field, chi field, is just transforming in some way which is defined by its properties under H, but in a way where the parameter that's describing the rotation under H is more complicated than the original one in the group generator, because this U involves implicitly theta twiddle and theta and G. So writing this out explicitly is supposed to show you that this factorization property, you're choosing a theta twiddle to make it true, and once you've done that, what's left on this side is a function of the choices you made for G, theta, and theta twiddle. And so in particular, because it depends on theta, it's space-time dependent. It depends on where you are in position space. And so the reason I kind of emphasize that is that we want to now make Lagrangians that are invariant under these transformation rules. And what we should expect to happen is that the things that do not involve derivatives, it'll be easy to do. And what will be tricky will be finding things that are, for instance, if I want a Lagrangian involving chi, a piece of the Lagrangian involving chi, which is not invariant under the group, which is invariant under the full group G, these transformation rules tell me that all I need to do is make an invariant under the group H. So I just find some random thing which is invariant under H that has no derivatives, and then The transformation rule under G is the same transformation rule. I'm just doing an H transformation, so it'll be automatically invariant. So that'll be the easy part. The thing that will be tricky is the things in the Lagrangian involving derivatives of chi or derivatives of theta, because those things care about the fact that we're doing transformations in H that are not constant parameter transformations, because the parameter of this transformation U depends on theta and theta twiddle, and those are fields, so those are now local, whereas the original symmetry was something which is only a global thing. So we have to kind of deal with the fact that we're doing local transformations now when we think of G acting on chi and on theta. That's the price we paid. Here we had transformations for G that were constants everywhere. It was easier to make Lagrangians out of that, but by writing things in this way, we've separated the action of the symmetry. Those transformations mix the thetas and the chis up, but here the transformations are taking the thetas to themselves and the chis to themselves in a theta-dependent way, but the price is that we're now doing kind of a space-time-dependent transformation. So any non-derivative interaction involving chi that was H invariant is automatically G invariant, because if we had something like chi transpose chi, which under H went to chi transpose H transpose H chi, which is chi transpose chi. So if, you know, L was equal to that, say, for H and H, then under G, what's happening is that chi transpose chi is going to chi twiddle transpose chi. That's the G transformation rule, and that transformation is chi transpose gamma transpose gamma chi. But this is still equal to 1 because it's still an H. So it's invariant for free. We're not expecting to find any non-derivative things involving theta, because that's the theta should drop out of the problem when theta is a constant. So then the question is, what do we do with the derivatives? How about terms that are H invariant but depend on d mu theta or d mu chi? And so the plan will be, well, we want to make things that transform in a simple way. And so what we'll do is we'll take this transformation rule and we'll write it in a way which kind of just depends on gamma, and we can do that if we could get rid of this G. So what we'll do is we'll consider the combination U inverse d mu U. That's something which I can certainly consider. It has the property that under symmetry transformation, which under G transforms, so I have to do that transformation rule. And so what's going to happen is in this transformation rule, because of the U inverse, you know, U is going to go to U twiddle, and U twiddle is G U gamma inverse. And in that rule, G is a constant. And so when I differentiate that rule, I'm not going to differentiate G. And so then when I multiply by G inverse or U inverse, the G inverses are going to kill each other, and there's going to be no G's left. So since U twiddle is equal to G U gamma inverse, so that means that d mu of U twiddle is equal to G times d mu of U gamma inverse plus G U mu of gamma inverse. So that means that u inverse u twiddle d mu u twiddle, that's what it'll transform into. That'll be equal to, so u inverse will go to gamma u inverse g inverse times g times d mu u gamma reverse plus u d mu gamma reverse. And so that's going to be, I can cancel the g's. In this particular term, I can cancel the u's. So the first term is going to go like gamma partial gamma u inverse partial mu u gamma inverse. So that's kind of a homogeneous transformation where it's doing a symmetry transformation. And this extra term is gamma partial mu gamma inverse. So another way of writing, we can evaluate the derivative of gamma inverse if we can write it in terms of derivatives of gamma. If we use that gamma inverse is equal to 1, if we differentiate that says that d mu gamma inverse plus gamma times d mu gamma inverse is equal to 0, because this is true for all parameters. And so now if we multiply through by gamma inverse and solve, that says that d mu gamma inverse is minus gamma inverse d mu gamma inverse. And so if we use that here, we've got this is gamma. So I've got gamma times gamma inverse right. And what you're supposed to think is that this kind of a transformation rule where I do kind of a similarity transformation then plus something involving the derivative of the group element, that looks like a gauge field. That's kind of like for an abelian group, if this has just been phases and gamma was e to the I omega phase, then the e to the I omega phases would cancel here and I'd just be left with the derivative of the phase. And so then this would be saying, in the case of abelian group, the gamma inverses kill each other, and I'd just be saying that this thing goes to itself plus the gradient of the parameter, which is for the abelian group what a gauge field would have done. For a non-abelian group, this is what the non-abelian gauge field would have done. So this is looking very gauge field like. But this guy lives purely in H, whereas this guy, if you think about this, the derivative of U is like an infinitesimal element of U. And so that'll be kind of U, one plus an exponential of the generators, and then the U inverse gets rid of the U. So this combination should be something which is some linear combination of the generators. So it's gonna be useful to, since this only lives in H, it'll be useful to separate out the pieces here that live in X, that are involving the X generators, and the ones that are involving the H generators, because the H generators are the ones that are going to have the shift in them, and the other ones aren't going to have a shift in them, but they're going to just transform in a simple way. They're going to go to themselves times gamma inverse. So what we'll do is we'll write U inverse d mu U. That's some of the generators, and let me just use the notation that I use in the notes here. I'm going to call this minus I times curly A mu of theta alpha, no, sorry, I times Ti. So that's supposed to suggest this looks like a gauge field. And that's because of this transformation rule here. And then the other thing I'm going to call it I E alpha mu of theta of X times X alpha. And sometimes it's going to be useful. You know, the mu index here is a space-time index, and that's coming from differentiating things. And these u's are functions of theta, so I know that the u index here, the way that mu will appear in this thing is going to be differentiating theta. The only reason that things here depend on space-time is because these u's depend on theta. So it's also useful to write that explicit factor of theta out. So I'll sometimes write this as minus I ai alpha of theta times d mu theta alpha. And the same thing here. So this is E alpha beta of theta times d mu theta beta times x alpha.
This is coming from our definition of u is v
Yeah, so if I think of differentiating that and I ask where do the derivatives hit, what depends on x? It's only theta. So I know that whatever the thing is on the right-hand side, it has to be proportional to d mu theta. So you're asking about the second line or the first line?
Yeah, what's the second?
Which, I mean, this piece? Sorry. Are you worried about this line or this line? This one.
Okay,
so what I've done is what I'm using is the fact that this thing lives in the algebra of the group,
right.
And so that means I can write it in some linear combination of the generators, so, and the basis of them are a bunch of t's and a bunch of x's, so that's what this says. It's just here's a bunch of linear combination of t's and x's, and I'm just calling the coefficient e, and I'm calling the coefficient I here, or ai. They all have an index mu because of this index mu here, but that's, I know it's because these, when I differentiate u explicitly, I'm going to pick up, what'll happen is if I differentiate u, I'll get things like u times derivatives of the generators. And so I might as well write those derivatives explicitly. And then, so this is the statement that I've got a combination of generators with some coefficients, and then I'm just now, all I'm doing is I'm extracting that the space-time index of this thing is really coming from a derivative of theta, and that's all I did. And the claim is that because of this transformation, if I kind of equate the transformation rule of this to this, the thing that has this term in it is purely this guy. And this guy doesn't have it because this lives in x, and these guys are all proportional to the t's. Right? This is the ui and ti, or derivatives of it. It won't be ui, but it's the, because this is the thing that lives in h, these are all, you know, gamma lives in H, so if I differentiate it, I get things that are living in the algebra of H. And so this is all living in the algebra of H. So these are all these never have X's in them because it's a subgroup. Whereas this has both because it's the thing that I expanded. So the so I can read off, by comparing this to this, I can read off the transformation rule. And the transformation rule will be that minus I A I mu of theta times ti goes to gamma, so I can get rid of the, I can multiply through by the minus I, goes to gamma ai mu of theta ti times gamma inverse. Then also minus this that I multiply through by minus I, I'm going to get plus I gamma inverse d mu gamma. So this is what a gauge field does. And the reason that I say that is that gauge fields are normally the things that you add to derivatives to make them gauge invariant. So the claim will be that if I take derivatives of chi, add this to make a gauge covariant derivative of chi, then the gauge covariant derivative of chi will transform in a simple way. It'll transform in a way which does not depend on derivatives of gamma, because this will cancel the way that the derivative of chi transformed. Let me leave that down. And what happens to E will be E alpha mu of theta times x will go to gamma E alpha mu of theta gamma inverse, period. I want to stick something on top of that. That's probably okay now. So what's nice about this is that this is a simple homogeneous transformation rule. It's easy to make invariants out of this. I just something like the trace of emu, forgot the x. You know, the trace of emu, if I take the trace of this times itself and I could track the mu nu indices with the metric, that's something which will be invariant because the gamma gamma inverse will die out in the trace because it's cyclic. And so that's a way to make invariant things that are the thetas alone. And this is going to be useful because this will be the way to take derivatives of chi and make them invariant. So can build invariants from emu alpha. So for example, the trace of emu alpha x alpha e nu beta x beta metric mu nu. That's an invariant because if I do the transformation rule, I get a gamma, gamma inverse, gamma, gamma inverse. The gamma, gamma inverse here cancels, and the gamma inverse here I can put around this side in the trace and make an invariant. And if I define a covariant derivative of chi to be partial mu chi minus I, this curly A alpha mu of theta times chi, the claim is that this is going to transform in a simple way too. So if this, then d mu of chi is going to go to, so the rule here was if I differentiated, you know, chi went to gamma times chi. So the derivative of chi is going to go to gamma times the derivative of chi plus the, where I differentiate gamma. So I'll get d mu gamma times chi. So if I've done this right now, we know that this goes to, forgot the t again. I've got an index I, the ti chi. So this goes to this. I got minus I gamma AI mu TI gamma inverse plus, now I've got minus I here now, so I've got, did I get the signs right here? I multiplied through by plus I. I should have got a plus I here, right? Or I should have had a minus I here. Gamma inverse, d mu gamma. Chi. So that's the transformation of that term, and now I have to also transform that term. So I guess times t. I have minus I ai mu ti gamma chi. This is not an infinitesimal transformation, this is a full transformation, so this is just gamma chi. So if I've done this right, and I haven't quite, this is the one I want to look at here. So what did I do wrong? I've got the I wasn't careful in doing this term here, right? So if I factored out the gamma gamma inverse here, but I didn't do that here. So if I multiply the gamma through here, it kills the gamma inverse, and I've got a gamma inverse on the right. And so you can see what's going on is that now these gammas kill each other. I've got a minus d mu chi, d mu gamma times chi, and that cancels this guy. So this guy takes out this guy. And then what's left here is something which just transforms the same way that chi did. So this is just gamma times d mu of chi. And that's kind of how you define, that's what covariant derivative means. You've designed the covariant, the derivative, to transform the same way that chi did. And so now it's easy to make invariants, Lagrangians out of that, because now it's transforming in a simple way, and we can make invariants with that as easily as we could have made invariants under chi itself. Because as far as the transformation rules are concerned, now there's no derivatives of gamma appearing anywhere. So it can't tell the difference between a gamma gamma being a constant or not. So our Lagrangian will be, the rule is, you hand me any Lagrangian at all built from chi, which is invariant under H, constant H transformations. And we would demand that because H is the unbroken group. That's something which we we think should be a symmetry. It's never got broken. And the way we make a Lagrangian, we can take that any Lagrangian of that form, and for free, we can make it invariant under G by using these replacements. What we'll do is we'll, everywhere we had a derivative of chi, we'll put in this covariant derivative. So that's telling us how chi transforms to theta partially. And that will for free take H invariants and make it into G invariants, because the G invariants of chi is just a special case of H invariants, but a local one. And this gauge field is making the local transformations not be a problem. And then on top of that, we want a Lagrangian involving theta itself, and we can build that using these E's. And if we had been doing differential geometry, remember the program we were under was we were trying to make a Lagrangian for these Goldstone bosons, which we knew in a derivative expansion was going to be minus V of theta minus 1/2 something G alpha beta of theta times D mu theta alpha D mu theta beta plus chi terms, let's say, and theta, things involving more derivatives plus other terms. And I told you before in the last class that what we're asking for geometrically is that as we want V to be a G invariant function, must be G invariant. And the only solution, given that the thetas are shifting, that's implying that V is a constant. And we're asking for G alpha beta to have Killing vectors. For G transformations, where the Killing vectors are supposed to be whatever, you know, if delta theta alpha was, if I call that C alpha theta, we want those guys to be Killing vectors for this metric. And so the problem for this, the kinetic term for theta became, how do you make metrics that are invariant under these set of Killing vectors? And this is the solution, that if we've been doing a differential geometry course, a space like this where you have as many symmetries as you have coordinates is a homogeneous space, because you can get everywhere in the space to everywhere else by doing a symmetry transformation. And so it's a coset space. It's, you know, some group divided by some other group. And in this case, if I thought of the space, the target space for theta, the actions of G over H move points around. So these are the things that are G that are not in H. And the action of H just leaves a point where it was. And so it's just some sort of a thing that doesn't do anything. So if this had been a sphere, the three-dimensional rotations of a sphere, one rotation of the sphere just leaves any particular point fixed, where you just rotate around that point, but the other two move you around the sphere. So in that case, the sphere would be SO3 divided by SO2. The SO2 is the one that just rotates you around that point, and the other two generators move you around the sphere. And what we're doing here is we're constructing a more general homogeneous space for general groups. And the problem of how you make an invariant metric, the way that a geometer would solve it is this way. They build these are the Cartan forms or something, that you're building out of the group elements, these things, and you're building them because they transform in this nice way, that these guys are behaving like a Feuerbein, that if I take these guys and I make a metric, G alpha beta, I make it the group invariant thing, which in this case would be delta alpha beta times, in general, it would be the Killing, you know, I called, I think, N alpha beta the trace of T alpha T beta. That was something which was a metric, and I chose to make it for a compact group. I argued I could define my generator to make this delta alpha beta. But more generally, you could think of this as a it behaves like an invariant metric. Yeah, if you like, that's like choosing Gaussian local coordinates at every spot. And once I do that, the G is going to be N alpha beta times these Feuerbeins. So E alpha, too many alpha betas. Let's say gamma delta, gamma alpha E delta beta. And if you walked in as a geometer and saw that, well, you would have said, well, he set up a bunch of Feuerbeins on his space. They transform nicely under the group. He's got an invariant group invariant metric, and then, you know, in the tangent frame, And this is, therefore, a metric which will be invariant under all these killing vectors. And so this is essentially, so when I write this down as being the thing involving two derivatives, what I've essentially done is I've written this down with this particular choice for the metric. So you can kind of think of these guys as being, you can think of these guys as being the n binds of the fear, four dimensions would be the fear bind. I don't know what the German word is for many. Field bind, I guess. Like a V. For the space from which you can build the metric. So there's an issue here of whether this is the most general way of making things invariant, and the notes, the Goldstone boson notes I have makes that case that you can, this is a construction that's invariant, but you can just write down the condition for invariance of the Lagrangian in a derivative expansion, and you can show that the general solution is this. It can be written like this by changing variables. So that's the framework. So let me do an example, because since we invested so much time in this framework, let's actually, this is kind of where a lot of the effective field theory stuff came from historically, at least within particle physics, because it was understanding pions in this way that led to this general kind of picture that field theories are can be designed to encode in the low energy limit of essentially anything, and in particular the symmetries that describe Goldstone bosons. And you remember the program was, we had some statement that Goldstone bosons should be there when we spontaneously break a symmetry, and their properties were going to be restricted by the fact that there's a matrix element between the symmetry current and the ground state and the Goldstone boson. And from that, I can infer a bunch of properties by taking correlation functions of symmetry currents of the Goldstone bosons at low energy, but those properties are not so obvious, and you have to kind of go through the current algebra story. The point of this Lagrangian that we're constructing is that if we can build a Lagrangian, an effective Lagrangian in terms of those light degrees of freedom, and we build in the symmetries, then the currents are going to be doing what they have to do for free, because that was a consequence of the symmetry. So if we build in the symmetry, then any consequence that we draw from this Lagrangian will be a consequence of any Goldstone bosons that were coming from this symmetry breaking pattern, as long as we only ask about the thetas. If we ask about how they couple to other matter fields like the chi's, that'll depend on what these other matter fields are. But the physics of the current algebra is just going to be built out of, once I tell you what G alpha beta is, then at low energies where the two derivative terms are dominating, you know, this is a function of theta, could be a complicated function of theta. So that we're not saying that there's a Taylor expansion going on in powers of theta here. There's a lot of interactions here, and they're all kind of the same size in the derivative expansion. Kind of like in gravity, the Einstein action gave us many, many interactions where they all had two derivatives in them. This is, if we had been doing a sphere, what would have been appearing here would be the metric of a sphere. So for a sphere, the thing we should have been led to is something like sine theta. You know, the metric of a sphere is, you know, d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So if our two coordinates in that case were theta and phi, what we would have found here is there would have been some coordinates for which we could have written it as d mu theta plus sine squared theta d mu phi for the case of g equals SO3 and h equals SO2. There should have been two Goldstone bosons for that. And the claim I'm making is that you can always define your coordinates on this target space in such a way that the action of the group is the one that you think of, just ordinary action of rotations on a sphere. And then the metric on a sphere is unique up to normalization. And so there's a constant out front here which we can argue about. And I guess if I want this to be dimensionless, I should put in a constant here. So I'll call it f squared. But apart from that constant, the theta dependence is being dictated by the symmetries. And so in this particular case, we have a bunch of interactions between the theta field and the phi field. But this is all possible powers of theta. So it's not like there's some expansion going on. We really know what the function is because the symmetries are telling it to us. And so the content of that current algebra stuff for scattering of Goldstone bosons is in this metric. If I tell you what this metric is, we go through and we look at scattering of Goldstone bosons at low energy. We power count which ones appear at lowest order in the energy expansion, and it's going to be the ones coming from the two derivative terms, just like it was for gravity, the same argument. And what we're going to find is that the scattering is controlled by the interactions in here. And and those are dictated to us completely. So if I look at five particle scattering at low energies or 18 particle scattering, they're all going to depend just on this one number f. And so I get to take that from one experiment, but once I've done that, I've predicted everything there is to know about scattering of Goldstone bosons for this particular problem. And that was the content of the current algebra. And if we go to more derivatives, there will be similar statements that the coefficients will be governed by the symmetry, and they'll get weaker and weaker because there'll be more and more terms you can write down with more and more derivatives. And so I want to do the example of pions because that's a case where all these words go through. The group isn't this particular group, it's a different group. But there's a number f which governs the scattering of pions. And that f can be measured from the decay of pions to other things. And so it was the first working example of how this stuff works out. And that also is a simple enough example that you can see that these functions, although I gave them to you in general, is a series in theta, say, and I didn't go beyond linear order often. For simple groups like the SU2, you can just write the whole answer down. These formulas I'm deriving for these, the Feuerbein and the gauge fields, are analytic expressions which are, you know, non-trivial functions of the arguments. So I like to do that example in the, before we stop here. Yeah, it's a surprise when you first see it. Well, it was to me when I first saw it, but in retrospect, it's not surprising because if you kind of ask, if you just take that Lagrangian and say, what am I asking it to do? I've got a symmetry delta theta alpha, which is some function of the of theta, right? That's essentially, and we've argued what that function is, but that's what it is. And if I just say, what does that Lagrangian transform into? So then the variation of the Lagrangian, you know, the variation of the V term is going to be dV d theta alpha times C alpha. So that you recognize as being, that's, if you had been a geometer and you walked in the room and someone said, I have a scalar function on a space, and I ask, how does it transform under the action of a motion on the space? You would have said it's the Lie derivative of the scalar function, which is this, right? So this is like L sub C of V. If we do the same exercise for the metric, it's a little bit more cumbersome because we have to vary this. We have to vary this, so we're going to get two things involving derivatives of xi, but we have to also vary this. So we'll get a derivative of the metric with xi in it. And so when we do all that, we get f squared over 2. So the thing involving the metric, we're going to get d gamma of g alpha beta times c gamma. When we vary the other guys, we're going to get plus g alpha beta. We'll get d. D mu theta alpha, d mu theta beta. And if I now vary this guy, say I'll have g alpha beta, d mu of c alpha, but see I can differentiate the chain rule. I can write d beta c, or not beta, d gamma c alpha times d mu of theta gamma. And I still have this guy here, d mu of theta beta. And then I'll have the same thing with alpha and beta change. I'll have g alpha beta d mu of theta alpha d gamma of c beta times d mu of theta gamma. Right? That's just brute force how the kinetic term transforms. But again, if you walked in now and I showed you this formula, you'd say, oh yeah, that's the Lie derivative of g alpha beta. And the reason it looks like if you just came in thinking I'm doing scalar field theory and now I'm finding geometry, it sounds mysterious. But if you think like a mathematician would, that you have, these are all maps, that you have space-time coordinatized by x. There's a map theta, which takes you to a target space for which the coordinates are, so here the coordinates are x mu, here the coordinates are theta alpha. Then what we're really saying here is that field redefinitions on this space are really coordinate transformation of this space. And so when we start doing the manipulations of field redefinitions, from the point of view of this space, we're just doing general relativity. We're just doing coordinate transformations. And so we're finding that the variations of various things are what they find in general relativity for the same reason. But it's a very powerful thing because if you now you just translate everything you know about general relativity here to here, and it tells you how to find the, you can use all the tools of differential geometry to help you find invariant Lagrangians.
Really, this is just because we're representing.
That was the continuous part of it. So it's true that the important thing here was that we had a continuous group, right?
And then because all the groups, they're like, they have some interpretation on a manifold, right?
Well, this part over here is you know, if supposing I wasn't asking for symmetries, I just said, supposing I just do a field redefinition, I ask, what does the metric, how does the Lagrangian change?
Yeah.
So I'm not asking it to be invariant. I say, what just does change, what's it change into? The statement here would be that under field redefinition, the potential scales, it changes, its variation is the lead derivative of whatever your redefinition was. And this says this coefficient of the kinetic term, which is a metric, it's a symmetric tensor, it's transforming like a tensor under a field redefinition, and it's symmetric, and it's positive if the kinetic energy is positive. So this is really a metric on your target space. And so this is just saying that the change under any motion is a lead derivative of a tensor, is a lead derivative of the tensor. And then if we now restrict ourselves to the case of a symmetry, then nothing can change. So then if we ask that the lead derivative of the tensor be zero, which is the invariance criterion, then we're just restricting to a special case of this transformation rule. So the group is coming in when you ask for a symmetry, because if you have two symmetries and you do them together, you get another symmetry. So it always has this group structure. And the continuous part of it is the important part for the different, because that's what you're always doing when you do coordinate transformations, you're doing a continuous family of them. So I don't know if that's an answer to your question.
Yeah. So those can sign, give you the symmetry of the G over H, yeah?
Yeah.
They
give you all of G is the symmetries. So the H ones will be the ones that they don't take a particular point, they don't change it. But it's not the same H at all points. So if you think of the sphere, if I take the north pole of the sphere, the thing that's H is the rotations around the axis through the north pole. But if I take a point in the equator, it's the rotations in that direction are in H. So it's a different part of G in different places in the space. But they're all there. So every point in the space will be invariant under H, under G. But the H action is a trivial action, and it's only the G that moves you around the space. The G over H that moves you around the space. Because it's the broken generators that shift, and the unbroken generators don't shift. So that means that they take you and they kind of rotate you around the space, but they don't move you from the point you were started off.
So we wrote down that form for the covariance group just based on the fact that we knew the thing we needed was the thing we can't do.
Yeah, right. And that's where that's the definition of a gauge potential. It's the thing that you would add to the derivative to cancel out the derivative term. That's a physicist definition, anyway. Let me use the other board here.
Okay, just knowing how the gauge transforms, you could always kind of find what the covariance derivative should look like, I guess.
Yeah, because if you read off that, you know, this requirement essentially that they cancel, that would have led you to the transformation rule we had over there.
Yeah, so you could go the opposite way.
Right. And that's how you prove the generality, basically, that you do the variation under an arbitrary transformation, and you require the variation of where the parameter is undifferentiated to be zero, and then separately the variation of the derivative of the parameter to be zero, because the variation of Lagrangian will involve the symmetry parameter and its derivatives, because it's now a local transformation, and they have to separately vanish, because you could have taken an arbitrary function. And then if you kind of take the condition that those things all separately vanish in those notes, you'll see that you can go through and you can derive essentially that the derivatives of the fields are always appearing together in this gauge invariant way, covariant way. And so it's the same logic normally the logic you would have done for electromagnetism, you would have said, I have to invent a new field A that does this. But in this case, you're building it all, you can always build it out of the Goldstone bosons, which you knew had to be there. So it's not like it's a new spin one particle here, but it's just, there's a thing that transforms like a gauge field being built out of the ordinary spin zero particle.
Three?
Why three?
Oh no, I mean there should be a difference between gauge potential of with respect to gravity and electromagnetism.
Oh, so this.
Christoffel symbols. One of them has, I think, three, and one of them has two.
Yeah. You're thinking like the gamma, alpha, beta,
yeah.
Gamma has three indices. Why doesn't this? Because the way to think about that would be that. it's easier to think about the spin connection if you're happy with the spin connection. If I, the spin connection would have been something like omega, AB alpha or something like that. And when you're thinking that this is contracted with some Lorentz generator, so JAB or something like that. And so this combination is what I would have called this. So this is the JAB, and this is the thing. So that has one index, and then this is what I was calling I, if you like. So for Lorentz transformations, you, instead of using six, something of one to six, you use pairs of things going to one to four, but it's just a way of labeling it. And then if you go to the world basis, that's, you can think of one of these guys as being the index, and the other two are like the two indices we had here. Although this, strictly speaking, this is not doing general covariance for you. You know, it's true that if you do.
You mean it's not the covariant derivative with respect to that G?
This is the covariant respect to that G, but it doesn't yet have. If you want, you could do something like this for space-time transformations, but you then would then have to be more careful that the original transformations you had in mind weren't, you know, just rigid. I was assuming I started off with a transformation which is some completely internal symmetry, and so nothing depended on space-time. And it wasn't a Lorentz transformation. So if you went back to the original starting point and you put in at that point that you were doing a space-time transformation and then tracked all the differences that means, then this kind of a thing could work. But strictly speaking, what I did on the board was internal symmetry.
So this gauge field is not physical, is it?
It's not. It's physical in the sense that it's just really a function of these other fields, theta. A particularly convenient one that transforms in a nice way. So it's physical in the sense that it's a thing in the Lagrangian, but it's not like there's a path integral. It's not like you're doing a path integral over theta and separately a path integral over A, like you would have done if there had been a gauge, like a photon field.
Yeah.
This is just a function of theta, and theta you're doing a path integral over anyway, because that's the scalars that you knew were there.
And is this arising because the reason we ended up with this gauge field is because we chose to do a local symmetry transformation, but that depended on the field theta, right?
Right.
So now instead of being a gauge field of coordinates x, it's now a gauge field of a field theta.
Yeah, it's kind of the group only gave us parameters that were independent of position, but we kind of made them in this transformation rule because gamma, wherever gamma was, depends on theta. We're effectively doing a transformation which is space-time dependent, but it wasn't like the group was really originally space-time dependent. So in the construction that would lead you to photons, you're just imagining that G from the get-go is space-time dependent, and it's not inheriting its space-time dependence only through theta. It's because this is getting its space-time dependence through theta, you can choose a theta-dependent thing to fix it. But if it's really just local on its own right, you just need a new field to fix that. Yeah. The abelian case is the simplest one. So if we did all this for the abelian case, then it would have been really simple because then we would have just had theta goes to theta plus constant. So that would be the transformation rule. That was like the toy model. And so then what we would have found in that case is that if it's abelian, this transformation is overkill because these C's are all zero, and so these U's in particular are zero. So because if you have a U1 and you break it, there's nothing left because there's no H. So then the only thing to talk about is what's the analog of E, and that's just the derivative of theta. So then the short version of this story would have been that I would have had some Lagrangian built from the derivatives of theta and then maybe other fields. But now, that would be invariant under global transformations. But if I make local transformations, then this is not invariant anymore, right? Because if this is now a function of x, then this transforms. So this would now go to if omega equals omega of x, then d mu theta goes to d mu theta plus d mu omega. And so then you'd want to have a gauge field to fix that. But the interesting thing is that normally you would have had d mu theta plus d mu omega times theta. If we'd had if the transformation law had been delta theta is I omega theta, say, then the derivative of theta would have had a, there would have been a theta here. And so what's unusual here is that because this is shifting and not multiplying, we don't have any thetas here. And so because of that, the way we make a gauge covariant derivative, we can, if we have a gauge field who transforms in the usual way, then we can make a gauge covariant derivative. And what we do is we, but what it will be, it'll be d mu theta, but it won't be plus theta times a. Theta won't be there because there's no theta here. So what we just do is we'll just have a. So I guess it'll be minus a. That would be the covariant thing. So now we build the, so then the rule would be to do this. The first term would be minus 1/2, you say f squared d mu theta, plus da da da. And so if I write that out, that's this thing squared is the kinetic term for theta, but this thing squared is like what would be the mass term for theta. And so the thing is, but the thing is, this whole freedom to change omega is a symmetry. So you might as well choose it to remove theta. Because if this is a whole function worth, I can just use it to get rid of theta no matter what it was. If I take omega to be minus theta, if I do that, then this is just a. And in that case, this would just become a mu, a mu. And this would be the mass term. And so the eating of it was this. So when you have this gauge symmetry, and then you can remove the gauge symmetry by removing theta, and that's the eating of theta. And so before you did the eating, you had a massless spin one particle with two spin states, and you had theta as a spin zero state. But then after you go to this gauge, theta is gone, and now you have a massive spin one particle with three spin states. Because this is the transformation rule, is theta goes to theta plus something, but now this is a function, not a constant.
Yeah.
So you give me any function here, I can choose omega to get rid of it by taking omega as minus theta.
Okay.
So I can always choose a gauge transformation to get to theta equals zero from any configuration that you have. And so that would be, that's unitary gauge. Well, so the statement is that in unitary gauge, the spin states are easy to see. And so the unitarity of the problem is easy to see, but the symmetries of the problem are harder to see. So the gauge invariance and the Lorentz invariance are harder to see. But in the original gauge, Lorentz invariance is easy to see, but the spin counting is harder to see. So because everything's gauge invariant, they're both true. But that's the way it normally is in the gauge theory, right? In any one gauge, you don't see everything in a simple way, and it's the gauge invariance that gives you everything. So unitary gauge is normally where the spin degrees of freedom are easy to see, but the covariance is hard to see. And there's a non-abelian version of this. So because ultimately things would have a shift component to them, if you gauge the group G, then the Goldstone bosons that used to be shifting will now shift under a local transformation, and then you can always use that to get rid of them if you want, because they were shifting. So that has an interesting consequence, because at low energies, the argument here was that if at high energy somewhere you break a symmetry group, a global symmetry group, G to H, no matter how low you go in energy compared to that symmetry breaking, you always know that you did it, because the Goldstone bosons are in your theory to tell you that you did it. And so the Lagrangian is not, the functional form of the Lagrangian is only restricted by H invariance. So it's not being restricted by all the symmetry that G had. But the extra things in G that were not in H are there to tell you how the Goldstone bosons coupled everybody. And that's their entire content. But if you have a local symmetry, then if you have a gauge group G that breaks to H, at low energies you lose the information, because the Goldstone boson was the only thing that was around in the low energy theory to tell you that the symmetry got broken. But you can remove it by a gauge transformation. So the thing is that there's two equivalent ways of thinking about the low energy theory. One is, it's got this gauge invariance that's non-linearly realized. Another is, it doesn't have any, it's just H invariant and nothing else. Because if I work in unitary gauge, my Lagrangian had to be H invariant, period. And there's no more information. And so it has a bunch of massive fields in it. So the issue in practice is, if the scale of the symmetry breaking is very large or very small compared to the scale of what you think of your ignorance for the next level of physics, that's the important thing. If the scale is small, then all the fields that you need to have a linear representation of the group will be there, and so then you can write linear transformations for the symmetry, and then that's what you do in the standard model. Say you always have multiplets of the symmetry that are split, but they're not split so badly that you lose some particle to be heavier than your cutoff. But if it's true that the symmetry breaking scale is much larger than your scale of ignorance, then you don't have particles around that can transform under them. You'll get some nonlinear realization. And if it's a gauge symmetry, it's essentially gone. And so it's hard to, so people kind of talk about, did you spontaneously break the symmetry or did you explicitly break the symmetry? And for a global symmetry, that's content to that, because if you explicitly break the symmetry, the Lagrangian is not invariant. Whereas if you spontaneously break it, the Lagrangian is invariant, but the vacuum is not invariant. But for gauge symmetry, it's kind of a subtle, it's not clear there's a distinction, because if you explicitly break the symmetry, I could think of that as being a spontaneously broken symmetry in unitary gauge. And so, and if you give, so I can reproduce the symmetry by just taking your non-invariant Lagrangian, doing a symmetry transformation, and introducing this new field theta, which comes to me as the gauge parameter, and I call that my new field. And so that's, now I've got a non-linearly realized gauge symmetry, and it's the same thing as a broken, that's called the Stueckelberg trick, because the new field is the Stueckelberg field. So the message is that global symmetries, you break them anywhere, you know at low energies you broke them. Gauge symmetries, it's not clear if that the low energy theory needs to know that you broke a gauge symmetry at higher energies.
If you do a gauge transform so that your Lagrangian is no longer invariant under symmetry, then what does it say about Noether's theorem? Like, would that mean, because there you have like some physical current, right?
Yeah.
That depends on the symmetry of your Lagrangian, and that would mean that by changing your gauge, you would make a current disappear, which would make it seem as though your gauge is affecting physical reality. And that can't be right.
Well, so let's do this example. Supposing our Lagrangian was minus 1 f squared over 2 d mu theta d mu theta. If you just take the Noether prescription to this and you use this transformation rule, then what you'd find is that j mu is f squared d mu theta up to numbers. And so then that's so far so good. But now, if we now said that this is not a global symmetry, it's a local symmetry, then this is not gauge invariant. Right, that's essentially the same thing as what you said. But you know that only gauge invariant things are ever going to be physical anyway. So that says that if you thought you were going to use this for something, then think again, because it was only the gauge invariant things that should have been showing up in physical things.
Okay, so that's not okay. So that's a prescription to the current. Or that's an indication that the current is not good. Not that.
Yeah, well, and so you might. So then you'd ask, can I modify the, you know, there's a certain amount of ambiguity in the current, because there's things you can add to the current that keep it conserved, and you could add, can I add something to make it gauge invariant? And if you could, then that'll be the gauge invariant thing you want to talk about.
Okay.
This also shows you something else, right? Because the defining thing of a Goldstone boson was that it had a matrix element between the vacuum and the Goldstone boson state of the current, and this is obvious here now, right? Because this is a current which is linear in the field. So in this language, in the full theory, it could have been the Goldstone boson with some complicated bound state of some things. But in the low energy theory, the Goldstone bosons are weakly interacting because all their interactions go away when the energy is low. So it has to be true that matrix element is easy to see because it's weakly interacting. And it is because you've got a shift part of your transformation. That's why you've got something only linear in the current. And so it's always true that because of the shift part of the transformation of the Goldstone boson, the Noether current always has a piece to it, which is linear in the field plus other stuff. And that's the thing whose matrix element is always the thing that had to be there by Goldstone's theorem. So the whole thing fits together really nicely. So let me just kind of try and squeeze in telegraphically the Pion example, because there's a lot of physics in it, and it's kind of historically where it came from, and it shows you that it's not just a story. It's something which you can actually test with experiments, and it works. I won't say much about the test of experiments, but there's more about that in these notes here. And it also, the Pion example shows you that it's useful to think about this construction even if you don't have an exact symmetry. If you have a symmetry which is something which is almost a symmetry, but not quite, this is still useful because the Goldstone bosons have to be massless if you have a symmetry, if they're the Goldstone bosons for a symmetry. But if you had an approximate symmetry, they won't be exactly massless, but they'll be light because the mass term will be coming only from the term in your Lagrangian that broke the symmetry, and by assumption, that was small if it was an approximate symmetry. So those are called pseudo-Goldstone bosons if you have an approximate symmetry. So the the application to QCD and pions, but also it could have been for kaons, and depending on how many quarks you talk about. You know, the QCD Lagrangian has the form, it's there's a bunch of quarks that interact with the strong interactions, and they have masses. And then there's a piece involving the gluons, whose form I don't really care about right here. So Q is a column vector of all the quarks, and let's just take the first two, although you could do the first three if you wanted to, or you could do, you'll see what limits what you can do in a second, but let's just take the first two. And then this D here is an ordinary derivative minus I times a strong coupling constant times a gauge field. Let me use a different kind of letter, K, times some generator lambda, where this is acting on a color index. So you should think of these guys, I've got three of everybody. I've got three colors of quark, so I could say I got lambda K, or lambda, say, S and DS, where S is equal to red, green, and blue, or something like that. And then this is a matrix, which has indices, you know, S and R, if you like, and this would be multiplied by delta SR, DSR. So this covariant derivative has the property that we can do local transformations, unitary transformations on this 3x3 label that the colors all carry, which I'm mostly not going to write because I'm not going to really focus on what they do. So that's the U3 of color, or SU3 of color. And so these guys are the guys that are in here. Those are the gluons. And I don't want to focus on them. But the important thing is that they're the guys that bind together the quarks into hadrons. And there's a scale in this part of the theory, lambda QCD, which is something like 200 MeV. But if you look at the bound states, like the proton mass and the various, most of the meson masses, the masses of the bound states you get from the strong interaction part, they tend to be like 500 MeV and up. And there's lots of them. There's a whole bunch of hadrons that are, the protons are just short of, they're 930 something. And but what's special about the exception to this rule is that pions are lighter. So pions, they have a mass which is more like 140 MeV. And so back in the day, people, they also take part in the strong interactions, but they seemed like they were lighter than everybody else was. The generic scale seemed to be like the high hundreds of GeV of MeV and up. And these guys were lighter. And they interacted kind of less strong than you might have thought compared to other strongly interacting things. And the question was, is there a simple way of understanding their properties? There's a long story there, because that's why I didn't write out what it was, because it invites that question, but you asked it anyway. So the QCD Lagrangian is actually it's the non-abelian field strength, so it's F mu nu squared. So there's only dimensionless parameters there, but what happens is that the coupling runs, and so there's a scale at which the coupling constant becomes strong, and that's that scale. So what happens is that for energy is higher than this, the gluons behave kind of like photons do, and it's all perturbative. But once you get down to that scale, the interactions are strong enough that they start to actually confine things into the quarks into color neutral objects. But the important thing for what I want to say now is that this scale, which is the basic scale in the QCD problem, is bigger than these scales for these quarks. So the up quark and the down quark have a mass of a few MeV, and I probably have it written down here what it is. It's like 5 or 7 or something like that. Here we go. So there, you, because you don't get quarks in isolation, you have to infer their masses from things like the pion masses. And but the but basically, mu is kind of in a range, which when I wrote these notes was kind of the ballpark of 5 GeV or less, maybe. MD was in the ballpark of 3 to 9, let's say 9 GeV or less. The next one up, MS, was in the ballpark of like 200, so it's, this actually says 60, but it's, I'm actually surprised it's that big. Yeah, no, more like 170. So let's say it's like 100, let's say it's 100. I'm saying GeV, I mean MeV. So this strange quark mass is kind of comparable to this mass, a little bit lower than a lot of the other mesons. And then the charm and the other ones are heavier than the scale. So when you're thinking of the strong interactions, what happens is that the charm and other quarks, they have masses that are much bigger than the scale, and so they tend to interact with the gluons in a way where the gluons are behaving as if they were weakly interacting, so their bound states are more like the hydrogen atom. The strange quark is always kind of an odd one because it's not really lighter than the QCD scale. So everything I'm doing for these two quarks, you could do for the strange quarks, and that kind of gives you a story about the kaons. But the kaons, they're not particularly light. They're kind of at 490 or something like that. So they're the ones that are around here. So it's always a bit of a question of how strongly you take the strange story. But the up and down quarks are really, they're very light compared to the QCD scale. So that's why I'm focusing on them. So the reason I say that is that that means that you can think of this term as being much smaller than the rest of the Lagrangian for the purposes of thinking about how strongly interacting things behave. So the MU and MD is much less than the QCD scale. And so you can think of the Lagrangian as being approximately L naught plus L mass, where L naught is Q bar D slash Q without masses, and then the QCD, the gluon part. So this is all characterized by the scale lambda QCD. And this is small in the sense that it involves a mass scale, which is much lower. So L mass is Q bar MQ. So the nice thing about that is that this Lagrangian has a lot more symmetry. So if you think about the kinetic terms of the quarks, the kinetic terms are invariant under the quarks, go to an arbitrary unitary matrix. So they have a symmetry where the variation of the quark is the obvious one. Is you could imagine having, you know, I can do a unitary transformation in flavor space. So this is called flavor space, U and D and S and so on. So I can mix these guys in it by a 2x2 unitary matrix. If I do that, then as long as I do that with a constant coefficient, then the U dagger I get from Q bar will cancel the U I get from Q, and that'll be an invariant. And the D, nothing here depends on flavor, U and D. These things all depend on the color, but we're not mixing the colors up. They all have the same, these guys transform the same under color is why we can get away with it. So if we do this, we take a I over 2 times a parameter omega A, and I take a Pauli matrix tau A times Q, that would give me a 2x2 rotation, a unitary rotation of the quarks. So here I'm thinking that Q is U and D, and the Pauli matrix acts in this 2x2 space. But I can also do an axial transformation. I could do I over 2 omega, I'll call it omega, let's call it axial and vector, A, Pauli A, times a gamma 5 times Q. Because if I multiply by gamma 5, if I have no gamma matrices in between, that's not a symmetry. But if I have one gamma matrix here, because there's a gamma matrix already in the Q bar, then the gamma 5s cancel. So if the kinetic term has both of these symmetries, This would be SU, the way I'm writing it, this would be SU2 vector, and this is SU2 axial. Or another way of doing it is I could have taken the left-handed part of the quark and the right-handed part of the quark and do them separately. So I could think of that as being SU2 left cross SU2 right. And so that would just be a matter of grouping things with 1 plus gamma 5 over 2. And 1 minus gamma 5 over 2 rather than 1 and gamma 5, but it's linear combinations of each other. This has the advantage that these guys commute with each other, whereas I do two axial transformations and the gamma 5s go away. So All right, so far so good. If I have the mass term though, then I lose the axial thing. So the mass term is this is still symmetric, but this is no longer symmetric because the gamma 5, there's fewer gamma matrices here, and so then because of that, that you lose the axial symmetry. So this is not a symmetry of the masses. So the picture is that if this is small, I should be able to think of the QCD as having this bigger symmetry than it does in real life. But the failure of this to be a symmetry should be something which is, I should be able to perturb around the limit where that's a symmetry. And the corrections to it will be proportional to the quark masses. So then you go off the spectrum of hadrons and you ask, so do you see the symmetry there? And this part they do see. This is something which is if there's a symmetry, what are you expecting to find? You're expecting to find all the particles coming that are related by the symmetry with the same mass. It's not an exact symmetry, so they should be split by a little bit of mass, a little bit of energy, but they shouldn't be split by as much as hundreds of GeV because the splitting is due to something which is smaller than the scale of the bound states in QCD. And this symmetry there is a symmetry like that. This symmetry is isospin. So it is true that you get neutron and proton are split by a little bit compared to their mass. So they're related by this SU2. And the pion comes, there's a pi plus, there's a pi minus, and a pi zero. And those three things all have masses that are very similar, but split by a little bit. And there's a K and a K plus, say. And so things do seem to come in multiplets of this symmetry. So that looks like it's a good understanding. There's a good understanding of why the symmetry is there, because it's just a statement it's there because these masses are small. This symmetry, though, is a problem, because if this was there, you'd expect to find the neutron and the proton and then a parity different version of the neutron and proton all with the same energy, and you don't see that. And you don't find six pions here, you find just the three of them. So this one was always is kind of a problematic one. But this argument that you should be looking for particles to be related by symmetries to have the same mass is only true if you don't spontaneously break the symmetry. So thinking was that this symmetry should be there. It's not relating particles in the spectrum, so then it should be spontaneously broken. But if that's true, there should be a Goldstone boson for it. And so there should be a state which is created from the ground state by the current for the symmetry. And the particles for that should be not massless, but almost massless. They're not exactly massless because this is not really a symmetry of the real Lagrangian, but they should be massless in the limit that we turn the quark masses off. And so the amount by which they're massless should be set by some measure of how small 10 MeV is compared to 200 MeV. And that's what the pions are. So the claim is that this guy is spontaneously broken. And so there should be a matrix element between some Goldstone bosons and the current for this symmetry, the axial current. And there's three of them, I guess, so the GA. And the ground state of QCD, that's the assumption that people make. That's not zero. And then because you know how these things transform, you know everything there is to know about these guys. These have to be bosons because they're related by the zeroth component of J to the vacuum, and that's spinless. They have to be almost massless, but not quite, because they would have been massless because this is a conserved current if the masses are zero. This is a parity odd thing because of the gamma 5, so these things should all be parity odd particles, and the pions are parity odd. There should be three of them because there's three generators of the group. And so the proposal is that the pions are the Goldstone bosons for this symmetry because they have all the quantum numbers you'd need, and they're known to be light. They're not massless, but they're not supposed to be exactly massless. And so the whole picture of describing QCD in this way, describing the interactions of the pions in this way, is based on the idea that they are Goldstone bosons for an approximate symmetry, and Goldstone bosons will like to be weakly interacting at low energies no matter where they came from because of this Goldstone property that their derivatives, their non-derivative interactions should be getting weaker and weaker. So that's called chiral perturbation theory. So you're going to perturb in the masses of the quarks about a zeroth order Lagrangian that has this chiral symmetry. And it's chiral. Chiral just means that it treats left and right-handed things differently. And so the fact that you have an axial and a vector symmetry is the chiral part of it. And so let's stop there, and then I'll kind of very telegraphically write down, for this symmetry group, I'll just write down what the transformation rules would be, what all the things were that we talked about here, what the metric is, as explicit functions, because it's an example where you can just, it's non-trivial, but you can actually write the functions down, not as just a series of powers of theta. And you can see why it's predictive, because there will be one constant f whose value we'll get because of this matrix element will be the thing governing pion decay. And then that's then dictating what all the pion scattering amplitudes have to be. So I'll start.
Is it the only model for describing pions?
Well, you can do more detailed things. You can try and actually take the quarks and try and solve QCD, and that's hard. Or you can make, people make various kinds of models where the more you make assumptions about what the dynamics is that are not just symmetry consequences, the more, if you're wrong, what you don't know is if you've falsified the theory or you've just learned that your model was wrong. So what the virtue of this is that this is something where it allows you to have to predict things, properties of the pions, which don't rely on you on having a detailed understanding of how they were constructed. And it's if it fails, then it's a serious failure in the sense it's only relying on the symmetries of what you thought was going on in the Lagrangian. And so there are more detailed things you can say. And so what this won't tell you very effectively will be, you know, there'll be some processes where pions, say, scatter from nucleons. And there's some things you can say about it that are coming from the symmetry. But there's some things that you can't say about it that are not just properties of the symmetry, that depend on the details of QCD. And those, this has less to say about. And there you just have to do an honest job of solving the problem.
So quantum theory, claim that there are some particles called Wilson bosons. And
yeah.
So how can you just justify them in the experiment?
One thing you do is you can just see if the predictions of the Goldstone boson Lagrangian I'm going to get to are true. Because it's going to make a bunch of statements about how they scatter at low energies. And so that's been done, and it works very well, actually.
Oh, you mean it's acceptable to all physicists that Goldstone boson radiates?
Yeah, well, this is not the only example. I think people who think about the strong interactions, there's no doubt that the pions are Goldstone bosons for this symmetry. Because I think one thing you could do is you could ask, so does the QCD spontaneously break the symmetry? And so then people study on the lattice what the vacuum of QCD is, and does it break chiral symmetry? And it looks like it does. And so there's people spend many years trying to see if all the various loose ends of this thing can be tightened up, and they've done a pretty good job of it. So this is, people take, they actually believe the pions are behaving this way. Kaons, to a less approximation, because it relies on the strange quark being light. But there are other Goldstone bosons in nature besides this, like phonons in a solid are there because you've broken the translation invariant. So the Goldstone bosons are appearing in a lot of ways, and there's no doubt that that's happening.
You just mentioned they test whether or not the vacuum obeys chiral symmetry.
Yeah.
How do you, like, I can see how you would test, like, the mass of a Goldstone boson, and that would tell you whether or not you've broken. But how do you directly test?
Well, you do something like this? Or you could, you find in that case, it's in the end of the day, it's a. So I guess the honest answer is I'm not sure exactly what their best test is, but if it was me, you know, the naive thing what you do is you just say, well, calculate the vacuum and I see, is it invariant under the symmetry? But the subtlety there will be this issue of tunneling that there's going to be, you know, remember for the ammonia molecule, you always had the symmetric and the anti-symmetric states, and there was a state there which was invariant. And so in the field theory, what's going to happen is you'll have a finite number of states in your lattice story, and you'll have to be able to deal with that cleanly. And I don't know how they deal with that myself off the top of my head. But one thing that you could do is you could calculate this. If this is kind of also the sign that there's, you know, if this had been zero, you know, the reason that this had to be non-zero was that if I took the variation of the order parameter, delta psi was phi, and I have a non-zero expectation value for this, then that was only possible if something like this was non-zero, right?
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is, to me, all of these symmetries are just internal symmetries of the field. It's just how one field transforms into another.
Yeah.
And when you're describing it, it almost sounds like you're describing a physical symmetry. Like, it sounds like you're looking at some, basically, I measured, to figure out if something's rotationally invariant, I measure it in one particular orientation.
Yeah.
I rotate it, I measure it again, I get the same thing over and over and over again, and rotationally invariant. So
yeah.
Like, what are they varying?
are they varying the internal symmetry? Like, how is that a physical thing you can vary?
I'm not sure what you're asking there. So the, in principle, you know, in principle, what they're doing, this is not what they're doing, but in you know, theoretically, what they're doing is they're diagonalizing. They have a Hamiltonian, they're diagonalizing it. And so they, you know, in principle, what you do is you take the Hamiltonian for the system and you find the lowest energy state, and that's the vacuum. And then that's something which you got. It's a state living in the Hilbert space of operators, and you know, and you have a specific transformation of those operators, so you can ask, what do those operators do to the ground state? And that's conceptually what they're doing. In practice, that's not what they're really doing. I think what they really do is they go to Euclidean space, and then they calculate a correlation function in Euclidean space, and then they look at the separation in Euclidean space that's a long separation compared to the QCD scale if they can. And then if you put a complete set of states into that, then you know normally if you have kind of an operator state operator, you know, ground state, say, then if these are different times, the time evolution, the dependence of this correlation function on time is going to come from the e to the minus I energy of the state times time, t minus t naught. But in Euclidean space, that becomes an e to the minus. So if they make t large enough, then what happens is that only, you can just take some random state here, you know, x. And what will happen is that the state that'll survive is the one that's the lowest energy for which these correlation functions, these matrix elements are not zero. If you make t large, everybody of higher energy is dying exponentially fast, and so then you pick off the guy who's the lowest energy state. And that's the kind of thing they do when they're trying to calculate the ground state properties. So then, so because you're doing it that way, no, go ahead. Yeah, it's coming up soon, yeah. The bottom line is that you're at